Greetings, and welcome to the Pieris Pharmaceuticals, Inc. First Quarter 2019 Earnings Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A question and answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Allan Reine, Chief Financial Officer for Pieris Pharmaceuticals. Thank you. You may begin.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us for our first quarter 2019 conference call and corporate update. On the call today, we have Steve Yoder, our President and CEO, and Lou Maitis, SVP and Chief Development Officer, who will be available for Q&A. You can access the press release this morning on the investor relations page of our website at www.pieris.com. Now, before we begin, I'd like to caution that comments made during this conference call may contain forward-looking statements involving risks and uncertainties regarding the operations and future results of operations of Pieris, including statements related to the timing and progress of our clinical trials and preclinical programs. Our partnerships and our financial position and actual results or events may differ materially from those expressed or implied by such forward-looking statements. Factors that may cause such differences are described in our filings with the SEC, including our annual, quarterly, and current reports. The information being presented is only accurate as of today, and Pieris undertakes no obligation to update any statements to reflect future events or circumstances. With that, I will turn the call over to Steve.
Thank you, Allan, and thank you to everyone for joining us today for our 2019 first quarter earnings call. I will begin the call by giving a brief introduction to Pieris before discussing our pipeline progress and our plans for the remainder of the year. At Pieris, we are leveraging our proprietary Anticalin platform technology to develop protein therapeutics. Anticalin proteins are engineered human lipocalins, which are proteins that are naturally abundant in the body and serve to bind and transport various molecules. Because lipocalins, and by extension, Anticalin proteins, are smaller and typically more stable and engineerable than antibodies, they offer unique advantages to other treatment options, such as inhaled delivery to treat respiratory disorders locally or creating more complex bispecific formats to drive a desired biology, as we are doing in immuno-oncology. I'll now turn to a brief overview of our respiratory strategy. Anticalin's capacity for inhaled delivery informs our growing respiratory franchise. We are developing multiple inhaled drug candidates for respiratory disease in collaboration with AstraZeneca as part of a five-program respiratory alliance showcased by our lead program, PRS-060, and four other programs. Within this alliance, we have retained co-development and co-commercialization options for PRS-060 and two other programs. PRS-060 is an inhalable IL-4 receptor alpha antagonist in development for the treatment of asthma and is our lead respiratory asset. We look forward to presenting first-in-man data at the 2019 American Thoracic Society International Conference later this month. In that trial, a single ascending dose phase I study, PRS-060 was demonstrated to be safe and well-tolerated in healthy volunteers in nebulized doses ranging from 0.25 milligrams to 400 milligrams. This was the first Anticalin protein to be administered to human subjects via inhalation, and we believe that the single ascending dose phase I data helped to de-risk this Anticalin protein from a safety perspective. Further, as our lead program, PRS-060 serves as proof of concept for the inhalable administration potential of our platform, in addition to PRS-060 being a promising commercial opportunity itself. Looking beyond this first-in-human trial, we plan to present data from the ongoing placebo-controlled multiple ascending dose phase I study of PRS-060 in patients with mild controlled asthma with pre-screened elevated levels of fractional exhaled nitric oxide, or FeNO, and elevated levels meaning ppBs greater than 35. We look forward to presenting this at an upcoming medical meeting alongside our partner, AstraZeneca, with FeNO being a validated marker of lung inflammation. As a reminder, the objective of the study is to ascertain a meaningful pharmacodynamic and pharmacokinetic, or PK/PD, profile for the drug candidate. More specifically, we are evaluating the safety, tolerability, and PK profile of this drug candidate, along with its capacity to reduce FeNO, in mild asthmatic patients dosed with PRS-060 versus placebo. The ability of PRS-060 to reduce FeNO could reflect effective IL-4 receptor alpha target engagement locally in the lung, demonstrating PRS-060's therapeutic potential and better informing a phase 2 dosing regimen. As a reminder, our R&D strategy is focused on addressing clinically validated targets in new ways to develop differentiated drugs with relatively lower biology risk than a first-in-class therapy, and we believe PRS-060 is a great example of this strategy. In this respect, PRS-060 engages the same target, IL-4 receptor alpha, as the approved drug Dupixent or dupilumab. Dupixent, which is an injectable monoclonal antibody, was approved earlier this week by the EMA for severe asthma in patients with either high eosinophils or high FeNO. And this is the first time, to our knowledge, that FeNO has been the basis of an approval for an asthma biologic, which reinforces our conviction that the FeNO-reducing potential of PRS-060 in our ongoing Phase 1 multiple ascending dose study could create a significant inflection point for this program. And looking forward, assuming successful completion of the ongoing multiple ascending dose study, AstraZeneca will sponsor the Phase 2A study, details of which will be made available in due course. Once this Phase 2 study is complete, Pieris may exercise its options to co-develop and separately to co-commercialize PRS-060 in the United States. Additionally, we continue to advance two discovery stage programs we initiated last year as part of our respiratory collaboration with AstraZeneca, under which AstraZeneca may initiate up to two additional programs. And we also continue to advance the two proprietary discovery stage programs we initiated last year, and we plan to initiate additional proprietary respiratory programs later this year. I'd now like to turn to our immuno-oncology pipeline. As a reminder, our lead oncology asset, PRS-343, is a fully proprietary 4-1BB HER2 bispecific designed to preferentially activate tumor-specific T cells in the tumor microenvironment. We continue to enroll patients in our PRS-343 Phase 1 dose escalation trial for HER2-positive solid tumors with the objective of ascertaining the appropriate exposure levels of the drug candidate as measured by a desired PD response. We intend to report comprehensive data from the PRS-343 Phase 1 monotherapy dose escalation study later this year. And we also continue to enroll patients in the Phase 1 dose escalation trial in combination with atezolizumab, an approved PD-L1 inhibitor under a drug supply agreement from Roche, and we intend to report data from that study later this year as well. Beyond PRS-343, we plan to file an IND application later this year for PRS-344, which is a PD-L1 4-1BB antibody Anticalin bispecific molecule and is the lead program in our 5-program immuno-oncology collaboration with Servier. We also recently presented preclinical data for PRS-342, a GPC3 4-1BB bispecific drug candidate at a poster session at the 2019 American Association for Cancer Research, or AACR, annual meeting. Additionally, our Seattle Genetics Immuno-Oncology Collaboration continues to advance according to plan. And finally, I'll provide a brief update on PRS-080, which is a half-life optimized hepcidin antagonist for anemia. We intend to report results from the Phase 2A multiple ascending dose study for this program at the 24th European Hematology Association Congress, or EHA, on June 16, 2018. We'll also be sharing the data set with ASCA Pharmaceutical, who have an opt-in right to develop and commercialize PRS-080 in Japan and other Asian territories. This concludes my prepared remarks, and I would now like to hand back over to Alan to guide you through our financial results for the first quarter of 2019.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning again, everyone. For revenue, we recognized $8.5 million for the quarter ended March 31, 2019, as compared to $4.2 million revenue in the quarter ended March 31, 2018, reflecting higher amounts of revenue recognized from upfront and milestone payments, along with billing for development services from our partners. Research and development expenses were $14.3 million for the quarter ended March 31, 2019, as compared to $7.9 million for the quarter ended March 31, 2018. This increase in R&D expenses reflects increased clinical, drug supply, manufacturing, and salary and benefit costs associated with the advancement of our clinical and preclinical programs. General and administrative expenses were $4.9 million for the quarter ended March 31st, as compared to $4.4 million for the quarter ended March 31st, 2018. This increase in G&A expenses is attributable to both higher personnel costs and professional service fees, such as audit and tax. The net loss for the quarter was $10.3 million, or 20 cents per share, compared to a net loss of $8.7 million, or 17 cents per share for the quarter a year earlier. Now, turning to the balance sheet, total cash, cash equivalents, and investments as of the quarter ended March 31, 2019, totaled $110.8 million, as compared to cash of $128.1 million as of December 31, 2018. This reflects increased operating expenses as well as annual bonus payments, which were made in the first quarter. Our quarter-ending cash balance was also impacted by higher prepayments in the quarter of $1.8 million and the timing of payments from our strategic partners, which is reflected in a $4.4 million increase in accounts receivables on our balance sheet. With that, I will turn the call back over to Steve.
Thanks, Alan. And just in conclusion, I'd like to say we look forward to sharing the data from the single ascending dose study of PRS-060 in the coming weeks at ATS and the data from the ongoing multiple ascending dose study of that program at an upcoming medical meeting. We also look forward to sharing data from the monotherapy and atezolizumab combination studies of PRS-343 later this year, in addition to the filing of the IND for PRS-344. Thank you for joining us on the call today, and we now would like to open the call for your questions.
Thank you. At this time, we'll be conducting a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Our first question comes from the line of Umer Raffat with Evercore ISI. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good morning, guys. This is Bo for Umer and John. I have some quick questions on the PRS-060 program. First, on the single ascending dose, in terms of the systematic exposure, what dose in the single ascending dose is comparable to Dupi, and how should we think about that? And also on the long residence time of the PRS-060, how should we think about that, and what informed you to have the BID dosing in multiple ascending dose? And also on the formulation bridging phase 1, you mentioned on the clinicaltrial.gov you're going to use the Plastabi monodose inhaler for the dry powder inhaler. Should we assume that this is going to be the device you use in phase 2 and beyond? And could you remind us what are the some of the approved drugs using this device and your confidence level with this? Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Bo. We're scribbling furiously there to catch all those questions. So we'll start with the first one. What about the dosing regimen and information from the dosage, the STAT6 data you're mentioning from the single ascending dose trial, and what to infer around long residence time? I think Alan's happy to take that question.
Yeah. So you know what's public so far, Bo, is our is the abstract from ATS, and obviously the poster you'll see in a couple of weeks. So when we look at systemic exposure, we're not trying to get to Dupi-like systemic exposure. Now, when we see the full data set, you know, can we get there with high enough doses of our drug? You know, the answer is we can, you know, as you see in the abstract, we can show pretty robust STAT6 inhibition at very high doses that last, a significantly long time there. You think you would get consistent systemic knockdown of that drug. But again, to remind you, this is, you know, we believe asthma is a local disease, and this is a local therapy to address that, again, local inflammation. So that's our target here. We're not, you know, we're not saying that systemic exposure is necessary to drive efficacy with our drug. Now, we can get some systemic exposure depending on where we dose, and, you know, we'll look at what the efficacy looks like, both in the phase 1b from the multi-ascending dose study in mild asthmatics and looking at the FeNO reduction, and we can compare that to the systemic exposure that we end up seeing with those different dose levels. And then again, in the phase 2a, we'll be able to test that in the moderate to severe population as well. In terms of lung residence time, there's going to be some more information at ATS, so I'm not going to disclose anything more on that today. And why BID? I think at the present time, as you say, we think BID is a reasonable dose level to look for efficacy. Doesn't rule out that one day that we're going to look at once a day and determine if that is also an effective way to dose this drug. But we know that BID, or believe BID, gives us the coverage we need. And there's always potential to go to once a day from that. When we think about the bridging study, you know, we're using the InnoSpire nebulizer, which was the same as the phase 1a study, and as you said, the Plastiate monodose inhaler. You know, we've said previously our intention is that our phase 2a study will use the dry powder formulation, and AstraZeneca is developing that. And Astra is taking the lead on the DPI formulation and all the bridging work. So we're not giving additional details on that at this time. However, it's a small study to bridge the DPI formulation, and it continues to progress according to plan. So I'm not going to comment any more on device or anything like that. That's for AstraZeneca or Plastiate and what the approved drugs are that have been used in that. With that, next question, or sorry, Lou, do you want to?
Well, I'd just like to add another point that we're very pleased with the fact that we were able to show STAT6 inhibition, because it's really demonstration that the drug remains stable, and it also shows the ability of the drug, even then transiting through the lung, to continue to inhibit its target, and it's a direct demonstration of IL-4 inhibition as well. It's a very nice proof of concept in those studies.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Chris Shibutani with Cowen and Company. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, this is Pam Barron on for Chris. Good morning. How does your respiratory strategy differ between your proprietary programs and the programs you started to discuss a little more, at least making us aware of them, the discovery stage program? Thank you. And then I have a follow-up.
Good morning, Pam. It's Steve here again. Happy to take a stab at that one. You know, when we set out to form the Respiratory Alliance with AstraZeneca, we had a discussion not just across what types of targets we might want to engage, but also areas outside of asthma, but yet within respiratory disease, that's all driven by the ability to drive local biology. And as part of that discussion, part of the alliance, we crafted a set of targets that would generally guide the operations going forward. Now, we didn't lock in 100% of the targets at day one, but we had a pretty clear idea of what those were. And as that is a high-priority alliance, and we wanted to take advantage of all of the target biology expertise that has been going on at AstraZeneca for years, those targets that we put onto a target list, which have some limited degree of cycling, those are generally informing how we're working together with AstraZeneca. And we're fine with that structure because, as you know, these are really truly collaborative programs, and we have the ability to co-develop two of those four early stage programs largely in the same way as we are able to co-develop PRS-060 if, you know, phase 2a data are positive. As for programs that we're advancing on our own, you know, we go through a pretty rigorous target validation process. Of course, we read the literature. We have an extensive key opinion network. I think we have one of the best respiratory ad boards in the world with really well-published, enthusiastic, very engaged advisors. And I think the way I would leave it today is to say our targets, which we're not prepared to disclose for competitive reasons, for intellectual property reasons right now, they, 2 points. One is we like the strategy in the near term of addressing validated targets locally, the targets that are validated clinically, maybe more systemically to go after them locally. And number two, not being constrained to asthma. You know, asthma comes with, you know, large or longer development times than some other respiratory diseases. And so it's a mix as part of our portfolio balancing. And I hope that gives you, a flavor of how we're striking that balance between what we're working on with Astra and what we're working on our own, and look forward to in the future, probably not this year, of disclosing some of those targets once we, feel more comfortable from a competitive intelligence and an IP perspective.
Thanks so much. And my follow-up question was on the IO program. So you mentioned the IND that you're hoping to submit this year with Servier. Can you provide any insight into your philosophy in this collaboration with regard to potential indications, whether there would be any overlap with 343 or if you'd be looking in a completely different direction so there wouldn't be any competition there or necessarily read through? Thanks a lot.
Sure, Pam. So I'm going to let Lou take an answer on this question. Thanks.
Yeah, so with this drug, which is a PD-L1 4-1BB bispecific molecule, we're not disclosing indications. One thing that we can say is that with PD-L1 as the anchor in the tumor microenvironment, there's a molecule that's expressed both on tumor cells as well as on cells within the tumor microenvironment, both myeloid and lymphoid as well. The range of different tumor types that one can address with a PD-L1 tumor microenvironment binding 4-1BB activating bispecific is really, quite large. And so it does give us a larger landscape of tumors to address. And I think that, we are in our discussions and strategizing with our partners in this, ultimately we'll make a decision about what tumor to go in first, but we're not mentioning that now.
Thank you very much.
As far as the combination, it's very attractive to us because it's a combination of a checkpoint inhibitor and a immune co-stimulator in one molecule. There's abundant evidence from certainly a raft of preclinical literature that PD-1 pathway inhibition combined with 4-1BB activation is quite synergistic, not only in generating an anti-tumor immune response, but in generating anti-tumor activity as well.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Biren Amin with Jefferies. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thanks for taking my question. Just on the asthma phase 1b trial, are you measuring anti-drug antibodies, and how should we think about immunogenicity with this drug? Thanks.
Hey, hi, Biren. Steve here again. There's an easy, maybe a simple answer to this. Yes, we are measuring for ABIS, and we are not at liberty to talk about any data from the ongoing trial. As a reminder, it is obviously confidential information under the AstraZeneca Alliance, and we look forward to presenting a comprehensive data set at an upcoming medical meeting, once the trial is complete. Thanks.
Got it. And then I guess on the other respiratory collaboration with AZ, when would we start to learn about additional targets that AZ is interested in? And I think you also have some in-house proprietary programs as well. So when would we learn more about those targets as well?
Hey, Biren, this is Alan here. So as far as AstraZeneca is concerned, the disclosure of those targets is really dependent on AstraZeneca. So, we're not free to disclose what they're developing, so you'd have to stay tuned for either, their pipeline disclosures, their potential presentations at medical meetings and things like that. As we've talked about, we've already started two additional programs on top of PRS-060. We have another two programs that will initiate likely this year, which will round out the total of five from that program. As far as our proprietary pipeline, I think it's the same thing. It's, Steve said earlier, for, you know, IP reasons and competitive reasons, we don't want to disclose everything for our target picks, but, you know, we're very, I guess, excited about our discovery efforts within the respiratory area. And as we get, you know, further along with data and get some preclinical data in-house that we feel good about presenting, I think we'll, you know, at some point and file IP, I think we'll get more comfortable about relaying to the street what those targets are.
And then I guess just from a proprietary respiratory pipeline standpoint, Alan, you know, is the company looking at large indications like asthma, or are there orphan indications that they could, that you could pursue with those targets?
Yeah, it's like this. It's everything is on the table. You know, when we think about you know, respiratory diseases, there's, you know, many diseases out there. Asthma is just one of them. You know, there's a lot of blockbuster drugs within the asthma paradigm. And when we look at T2 asthma, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit on targets that you can go after for asthmatic disease. But as you said, there's plenty of other indications out there, both orphan and larger indications that we can think about within respiratory. As Steve said earlier, we've built up a really broad, impressive network of respiratory KOLs and a really impressive scientific advisory board. In addition, we've really bulked up our scientific expertise in-house when we think about translational work within respiratory diseases. So we're really looking at, you know, the full gamut of anything respiratory.
Got it. Okay. All right. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from line of Matt Phipps with William Blair. Please proceed with your question.
All right, guys. Thanks for taking my question. I guess I'll ask on PRS-343, so continuing to enroll patients there, I believe kind of one of the last updates, you were at the approved Herceptin dosage level. So I was wondering, are you dosing above that, or is this really more backfilling previous dose levels with kind of the IO-responsive tumor types? And then additionally, you know, are you seeing, or I don't know what you can say at this point, but since you're using this same 4-1BB anti-kaelin in some of your other projects, I mean, are you getting confidence from 343 that this anti-kaelin is definitely, you know, active in the tumor microenvironment?
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Matt. Again, I'm going to let Lou take a stab at this one.
We're not going to comment on data. We look forward to presenting really a complete data set for both the monotherapy as well as a combination study by the end of the year. We are continuing in dose escalation to determine the best exposure for the drug. Not at liberty to say whether we've seen 4-1BB activation or not. What we can say, which is actually, we think we were very pleased to see that in a plenary session at the AACR, American Association for Cancer Research meeting, a little over a month ago, Roche, who has a very similarly designed bispecific, a tumor-targeted anti-4-1BB molecule, their tumor target was FAP, fibroblast activating protein, which is found in elevated levels in the stroma of different tumors, and they presented a single patient from in a plenary session, one patient from their trial who had achieved a clear partial response. So that was basically their validation of the fact that a tumor-targeted 4-1BB bispecific can work both with respect to activating the tumor microenvironment and eliciting a objective response in the tumor itself. And that's public data, that, you know, those that's public presentation. So we are looking forward to presenting our data later this year as well.
And Matt, just to add to that, you had asked around doses vis-a-vis indicated Herceptin levels. I think they're different. So we are exploring exposure levels of our drug to, you know, that would be higher than what you would dose with trastuzumab. given that there are bispecific target kinetics at stake. So I would say that there are two ways to do that. You could do absolute dosage, dose amounts, as well as frequency. And so those are things that we're looking at as we continue to escalate. But of course, we also have the flexibility, as you mentioned, to backfill. And our protocol has a lot of flexibility to go up to at least 10 patients per arm. And so we are also exploring that and are guided by a totality of data from drug-like properties and PD of patients in any of those given arms on the way through escalation.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you'd like to join the question queue, please press star 1 at this time. Our next question comes from the line of Joe Pantginis with H.C. Wainwright. Please proceed with your question.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Wanted to focus my question on the co-development option for 060. First, from a logistical standpoint, can you just remind us how long you have to make the decision on your front? And then number two, even if it's just a broad stroke financial answer with regard to maybe the net effect of your co-development participation, meaning obviously your expenses would increase with the co-development, but there would also be a offset from milestones from AstraZeneca, so maybe what the general net effect might be for your participation if you were to co-develop. Thanks.
Hi, Joe. So I'll take a first cut at that. If anybody wants to add to it, feel free. So there's two questions there. It's maybe the mechanics of being able to look at the data, share the data, and decide whether to opt in, and then the second part is the return on investment as a function of our co-investment if we choose to go down that path. So on the first point, we these are all confidential terms under the contract unless otherwise disclosed. So the precise timing of the opt-in decision, which again is after the phase 2A data are available from the forthcoming phase 2A trial, we haven't disclosed the specific time period. However, what we have disclosed is that it was important for Pieris to be able to disclose the essence of those data, to be able to get credit for them if they're positive in order to inform the potential for the drug going forward in order to then access the necessary capital to go forward in co-development if we choose to do so. So there will be an opportunity for the street to be able to understand what those data are to understand our basis for moving forward if we want to move forward in co-development at that time. Number two, as for the leverage on return on investment as a function of sitting back and just enjoying milestone and royalty income versus co-developing going forward with AstraZeneca, you know, we again haven't disclosed specific details on the milestones or the royalties or the full impact if we were to go at the full threshold of co-development. However, what we can say is that beyond just sitting back and enjoying milestone and royalty income with no investment, we can invest in multiple tiers. And depending on the level of investment that we would take, we can in some instances increase the milestones and the royalties into the high teens, and that royalty stream would continue as long as sales continue. And at the highest threshold, we can convert the royalty into a gross profit split on the basis of global sales, again, for so long as sales continue. And we structured the deal that, in our belief, allows us to, with each dollar invested in the program, allows for a more leveraged return on investment. And so if the data were, in fact, positive, looking again at FEV1 lung function improvements, today, as I sit here today, I think we would really like to be able to invest as much as we can in that program because we believe that's a significant de-risking point for the program. And number two, the way the mechanics are of the contract, that would be the best return for Pieris shareholders long term.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our question and answer session. I'll turn the floor back to Mr. Yoder for any final comments.
Thank you. No, I just want to thank everyone again today for your attention and for your continued support. We look forward to keeping you updated on our progress and the disclosure of data for PRS-060 in about 2 weeks. Thank you again for joining the call and have a great day.
Thank you. This concludes today's teleconference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.